Our next guest is a very dear friend, one of the architects of an epic struggle in the judicial process in defense of the Five. Please welcome, with our open hearts, Mr. Leonard Weinglass.
Representing the Five, I want to thank you all for being here today and for your support. As you know, it's been 8 years of confinement for the Five up to this point in time. They were arrested in September of 1998, and I've been given 15 minutes or slightly less to explain the 8 years of their struggle in the criminal system in the United States. Their arrest followed, as probably most of you know, a four-decade-long period in which terrorist actions, were taken against Cuba from the shores of South Florida. Those actions were protested by the Cuban government to the United States, and the Cubans even introduced a resolution, I believe it's the first resolution, into the Security Council condemning terrorism emanating from the United States and directed at the Cuban people. The United Nations has still not acted on that resolution. But after repeated acts which increased throughout the 90s, when Cuba attempted to establish a tourism industry, and the folks in Miami who were opposing the Cuban government called for a press conference declaring all of Cuba an open combat zone and warning anyone who planned to come to Cuba as a terrorist from Europe or Canada or Central or South America that they were entering a combat zone. That was done as a way to dissuade tourism from coming to Cuba and destroy the efforts on the part of the Cuban people to recover from the loss of their Eastern European economic allies. It was only after the airport had a bomb found in it, a bus was bombed, hotels were bombed, boats were drawn up off the coast of Cuba, which had cannon, hotels were shelled, that these five men came forward and agreed to go from Cuba to the United States in order to infiltrate these groups that were operating with impunity from Florida against Cuba. These groups were functioning from bases which were known and which were on the TV news. These bases had men practicing with automatic weapons, with explosives, wearing camouflage uniforms, reminiscent of what we all saw on American television after 9/11 of the camps in Afghanistan, where terrorists allegedly were trained there. And the United States government did nothing to stop it. So the Five came here, they infiltrated these groups, and they reported back to Cuba on the activities of these groups, saving, in a number of instances, many lives by forewarning Cuba of planned terrorist actions against Cuba. In June of 1998, the Cuban government invited representatives of the FBI to come to Cuba, where they were given three loose-leaf notebooks, videotapes, audio tapes, photographs of the activities of these groups. And the FBI said they would return to Washington and investigate these groups because they were allegedly violating U.S. laws on the Neutrality Act, where no American is permitted to launch a war against any neighbor or other country. That area is reserved for the United States government alone. And the FBI never got back to the Cubans who had provided them the information. Instead, in September of 1998, they arrested the five who had gathered much of this information. Their trial became the longest trial in the United States at the time it occurred. It consumed over 6 months. 119 volumes of testimony was gathered. Over 20,000 pages of documents were introduced as exhibits. Generals testified, admirals testified for the defense, for the five. The advisor to the President of the United States on Cuban affairs testified also for the defense. But the trial was held before a Miami jury. And at the conclusion of the 6 months, the defendants were convicted of each and every one of the 26 counts that were lodged against them. Now, I want to say a word about the 26 counts. Most of the counts were minor. 24 of them were minor. As a matter of fact, they only involved using false names, entering the country illegally, failing to file with the Attorney General of the United States that they were functioning in the United States as foreign agents, something which the United States government seriously thought should have occurred. And these charges together would have probably, if they were convicted of the 24 charges, they would probably be eligible for parole now or close to it. But there were two major charges. One was conspiracy to commit espionage, and the other was a conspiracy to commit murder. The conspiracy to commit espionage, what happened in this case is the fact that they had infiltrated these private groups, which were military groups, quasi-military groups, was taken as an act of espionage against the United States because they succeeded in infiltrating those groups and reporting on them. But that's not espionage. Espionage is providing secret information to the United States government of a military nature. The prosecutor in this case said to the jury at the beginning, on the very first day, we don't have a single page of classified information in this case. Not a single page of closely held government information. This is the first conspiracy to commit espionage case in the history of the United States without one page of classified information. In fact, and you must be careful about this, they were not charged with espionage. They were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. That is, the government's claim was that these five Cubans had entered into an agreement, although they hadn't committed espionage, that at some unspecified time in the future, they might commit espionage. And it was that charge, not espionage, the charge of an illegal agreement that the jury in Miami found them guilty of. Secondly, on the charge of conspiracy to commit murder, there was no murder in the United States. What happened was that two aircraft from a group called Brothers to the Rescue, which had overflown Cuba repeatedly in violation of U.S. and Cuban laws, were shot down by the Cuban Air Force. And in those planes were four occupants who died in the course of that shootdown. That shootdown occurred after there were 25 overflights of Cuba by this group in the 20 preceding months. The Cuban government permitted these overflights, but protested each and every one. Finally, they called a retired admiral of the United States, Admiral Carroll, to Cuba. And they told Admiral Carroll that Cuba now was going to begin to defend its territory and that the United States should take steps to stop these overflights. Admiral Carroll testified to the jury that he came back to Washington and he met with State Department officials in the Pentagon. And he told them that the government should take steps to stop these overflights because Cuba was going to defend its territory. In February of 1996, there was another overflight of three aircraft. One turned around and returned. The other two were shot down by Cuban MiGs. The government's claim against one of the five, and he was the only one charged with a conspiracy to commit murder, is that he was part of a conspiracy to shoot down those planes. However, the government had no evidence of that. And when the case was over, the government took an emergency appeal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals saying that if the judge instructs the jury that in order to find Gerardo Hernandez guilty, the jury must find that the Cubans had a plan to shoot these planes down over international airspace, not over Cuban airspace, that they could not convict the defendant, Gerardo Hernandez. The government went to the 11th Circuit and said to the 11th Circuit, we have no evidence of such a plan. And if this judge gives that instruction to the jury, then the jury most certainly will acquit Gerardo Hernandez. They called it an insurmountable obstacle to a conviction. The judge gave the instruction, the jury convicted without asking a single question. Gerardo Hernandez was sentenced to two life sentences, one for conspiracy to commit espionage, one for conspiracy to commit murder. And two of the others were sentenced to life sentences for conspiracy to commit espionage. Three are doing life, one is doing 19 years, one is doing 15 years. A word about the sentences. My client, Antonio Guerrero, charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, who did not seize a single page of U.S. classified information, is serving the same life sentence as Aldrich Ames, who stole tens of thousands of documents of the United States. The same life sentence as Robert Hansen, who stole thousands of documents of the United States, which led to the deaths of four agents of the United States. He is doing the same life sentence, although he did not take a single page of classified information. And that's true of the other two as well. And the one is doing 19 and one is doing 15. They were sentenced maximum consecutively. We took an appeal from these convictions, and we went to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. We argued before a panel of three federal judges. And for the first time in the history of the United States, three federal appellate judges, looking at the prejudice that existed in Miami against Cuba and these five, ruled that there was a, to use their words, a perfect storm of prejudice in this case against the five, and exonerated all of their convictions and ordered the case be sent back to a place where the five could get a fair trial. That was a 93-page unanimous opinion, the longest decision ever in the history of the United States on venue. We were very pleased with it. We rejoiced with that result. We prepared for the second trial, which we knew we could win. But Washington decided to appeal that decision to the entire 11th Circuit. And the case was heard by the entire 11th Circuit, 12 judges of the 11th Circuit. And sure enough, they overruled the fact that the three-judge court, which included three judges who had 80 years of judicial experience, were in error. And they reinstated the convictions. That just happened on August 9th of this year. And so their convictions have been reinstated. But there remains nine additional issues which now go back before two judges of the federal appellate court. And these judges are, as we sit today, considering these nine additional issues. They involve other issues in the case, and we are hopeful that if these two judges consider these issues in a fair and reasonable way, that the case will yet be set aside and the convictions will be reversed. But right now, we're waiting for the results of the review of these nine issues that are before a two-judge panel of the 11th Circuit. I have to say, and I've been told this by my colleagues who practice before the 11th Circuit, that not once in the last 25 years has the en banc court, the entire court of the 11th Circuit, ever ruled in favor of a defendant. That's a remarkable record that that court has. But that's what happened to us when we were before that court. But now we're before two judges of that court, and these two judges wrote a 56-page dissent when the en banc court reversed the decision on venue. And so we're before two judges who have already written extensively that an injustice has occurred in this case. And we're hopeful for that reason that these two judges will rule in our favor. Lastly, I would like to say that in my experience in political cases such as this, the size of the support, the extent of the support, the breadth of the support is absolutely critical and essential to what happens in court. Lawyers are not listened to in a case of this nature unless there are people outside of court who will stand up and stand with the five. So it's very important that in this critical period of time, while their fate is now being considered, that we all stand together in large numbers, making our position clear, encouraging others to stand with them, and to finally reverse this injustice and send the five home to Cuba.